Hello and welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats, or well, they weren't necessarily obsolete when we got them, especially this one, because our film for this episode is The Butcher Boy from 1998. And in 1998, The Butcher Boy was a film near and dear to our hearts. And at the time, the director Neil Jordan was kind of on a roll.
Yeah.
He had directed Michael Collins, The Crying Game, and The Interview with the Vampire, which it's hard to imagine people being excited about that movie as much as they were now. But we have it on VHS, and I believe perhaps the last time we watched this VHS tape might have been when we were in college, when we were undergrads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Weird thought.
It is indeed a weird thought, but we revisited it this weekend, and I guess we start with why it was near and dear to our hearts in the late 90s.
Well, actually, the first thing I was thinking of is that we're getting into, for this film, our first three podcasts were more traditional films that were in the popular conscious that you were able to find at your local cinema, where this is not. Butcher Boy is not something that you could walk to AMC theater and find. So for me, I appreciated the themes of trauma and child abuse and how you manage through trauma, but also there's this interesting build to the film, to the final end, which if you're paying attention, you know it's coming, but you're kind of shocked how it comes, because mm-hmm. It is this kind of red-haired, sweet-looking Irish boy.
Cute. Rosy, puffy cheeks, round little face.
Roguish.
Cute, yeah. Little accent.
Yeah.
Non-threatening name, Francie Brady,
Francie Brady. But I think at the time, where we went to college was very isolated, mm-hmm. So there wasn't a lot of options, and I'm a huge fan of independent films and independent directors. We didn't have a ton of access to it, so when you did have an opportunity to have access to something interesting, I think it really connected with you, mm-hmm. and had this deeper meeting. How about you?
Well, actually, and I will say this is a former Blockbuster rental copy. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I got a hold of it or how I got in possession of it 20 years ago, but I think there were some stores that sold repackaged. And this was there, and you probably had a $5 price tag on it. And I was like, dude.
Yeah.
For me, and this is part of the revisiting of the film, I think, in 2020. The theme of Catholicism, mm-hmm. in this, Catholicism is really important. And I say, okay, so we were students of what was then St. Francis College, which is a Catholic liberal arts university on top of the Laurel Highlands in lovely and beautiful Cambria County, Loretto, Pennsylvania. And I will say the Catholics of that town, as a very Catholic part of the world, while there was a very distinct ecumenical spirit at the time, where there's like, we're all on the same journey, no matter what you're doing, people were not in any way cosmopolitan.
Right.
And so they were not aggressively exclusionary. But we're talking about a lot of people who maybe been to Disney World a couple of times, maybe New York once.
Yeah.
And so they had all the answers. They understood the world. And the way that the Francie Brady character, in his roguishness, in his transgressiveness. He's a bad kid. I mean, he is a bad bastard. He's trying to get the Francie Brady's Not a Bad Bastard Anymore award. And it takes him a long time to get it. But you think the film even starts the penultimate scene. He's there in the hospital bandaged. You don't know why. He just has one eye that's poking out of the bandages.
And a character saying, "Why'd you do it, Francie?"
Yes. You would have broke your poor mother's heart.
Yep.
And so we get the penultimate scene first, and then everything else is the build. And yeah, the role of Catholicism, it's takes place in Ireland, takes place in a small town in Ireland, which is in a bunch of rolling hills, very much like the place we were living at the time.
Yeah.
And that you had these kind of towny characters that did not know how to deal with this kid. And so there was something delicious about that. And I guess the other thing to say about the Catholicism of it, I mean, the Virgin Mary is a character in this film.
Yeah.
And the Virgin Mary is played by...
Sinead O'Connor.
Yes. So it was naughty. It was naughty. There was a nice naughtiness to it that I think also really appealed to me. And like the Roger Ebert review of the time said, you know, it's a good companion piece to A Clockwork Orange. Mm. And it is, actually. I mean, we have to, maybe we want to be careful. People, you should see this movie. I mean, spoiler alert for the bottom five questions or the last five questions. Find this movie somehow. You know how to Google. You can do it.
Yeah.
See this movie. It's wonderful. So we don't want to ruin it for you if you haven't seen it. But yeah, there is a Clockwork Orange element to it because we're always with Francie Brady. We're not really with anybody else.
And I think going back to that connection of being in college, you know, it was in a very isolated place. And I know you and some of your friends found fun through destruction, right? And through kind of doing things that were... you didn't get much beyond harmless kind of fun things. But that also spoke to me of kind of being in a very isolated town where there's not much to do. And if you have kind of a spirit about you, like what do you do with that? And so, you know, what kind of starts out as just two boys being boys, really does change over time with it.
Yeah. And I think that's part of this build that we are innocent with Francie Brady, boys being boys. I think the way even the film wields Irish stereotypes as part of the way that it disarms the audience for the build, even, you know, oh, my dad was the best drinker in town, you know, and it's like even that, like, Irish as alcoholics is used against you as an audience member, and you're just lulled into this, you know, world of this. Well, I guess we can say Francie Brady's a sociopath, right? I mean, he is...
You know, I was actually thinking about this after watching the movie, because typically... so, you know, part of discussing it is we are going to give some things away.
Mm-hmm.
What you kind of learn over a period of time is that the narrator is most likely the voice in his head that he's hearing. And so he does have these moments where he interacts with the narrator. And
there's a big moment where he's doing a very bad bastard thing where suddenly he's having a conversation with himself, and that the voiceover, which it also is in this lovely Irish brogue, this very disarming, you know, it's the voice, the narrator's voice is the voice you would want around a campfire listening to old Irish ghost stories.
Yeah.
You know, it's that voice. And then suddenly they're in dialogue with one another, and he's about to do something really nasty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you have to, you know, I was thinking, like, typically, like, schizophrenia actually doesn't really manifest until you're older. Mm. But he is having hallucinations. He is hearing voices. He does see people look like aliens in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like he has these schizoid tendencies where he's definitely having hallucinations. He's definitely hearing voices. And though that is ends up driving his particular actions. And I think the thing that's really fascinating, because of the time period, because it's in the middle of the Cold War, so nuclear destruction is very much in people's minds. There's a lot of, like, alien invasion films. He's really into Westerns and gangster films and gangster shows. So he's created this world with his best friend, where it's actually probably very real worlds for him that he's creating, that's just pretend for Joe.
Yes.
And so you don't necessarily, initially you're just like, oh, these are cute boys enacting their fantasies from the movies that they have watched and the shows that they have watched, where you actually start to realize these are actually real worlds, probably for Francie, and mm-hmm. he can't distinguish reality from fantasy, and that starts to get him in big, big trouble.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that for me is so interesting, and I guess that's why I said sociopath, because he's a boomer. And you know, and it is this, I mean, there is that book Generation Sociopaths about boomers, and it, you know, one of the arguments against it are like, well, don't go so hard on them, they were the first generation to grow up with television, they had parents that were maybe scarred by the war or had their own issues, mm-hmm. there was this idea of nuclear annihilation, so the Cuban Missile Crisis in particular,
yeah,
builds, is a subplot for the movie. You know, this adult, I guess that's the other thing that captures, you're in the world of Francie Brady, which is a child's world. And adults are these peripheral figures.
Which actually, you think about it, which is so different from now, where you have the helicopter parent phenomenon.
Yes.
But there are big chunks of the movie where it's Francie Brady by himself or with his friend navigating this world, which is fascinating. That's not something we really have now. I couldn't imagine parents letting their two boys by themselves in the center of town just joke around tripping at ice.
Yes.
That is definitely something different. But I apologize. You were talking about that book.
No. But this idea that there's also this profound threat of no tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's interesting because you're so isolated in that world. One thing I do sometimes say when I teach a freshman writing class in the fall semester, eventually it comes up where I say, you know, this is the beginning of the journey, the lifelong journey of figuring out your childhood. And things will be revealed to you 20 years from now that happened 5 years ago that you were aware of, but maybe you didn't fully process, maybe you didn't fully understand other people's motivations, which I think is also, for me, the way, I guess, now that I'm older and maybe a little less callous and a little less, yay, violence! You know, I mean, the film, I do see it with these different eyes, because maybe I was just figuring out my own childhood at the time I saw this film. Mm-hmm. And I could very much relate to Francie Brady's rage and destructiveness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we can't ignore the fact that he has a very traumatic childhood.
Yeah.
His father is an alcoholic, an abusive alcoholic, and his mom is probably manic depressive.
Mm-hmm.
There are these, you know, you don't see mom a lot, but when you see her, one scene is a depressive scene, another scene is a manic scene.
Yes.
So you can tell she has her own mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, now having a son who's struggling with his own issues, you know, they were kind of wrapped up in their destructive relationship rather than seeing what was happening with Francie. And that he really needed help and support. And you think of the adults around him, even the priests he encounters, either the parents of other children, it's all he's a bad bastard instead of like, no, this is a child who is in a really traumatic situation and a really difficult situation. And everybody is willing to talk about how bad it is for Francie and what can you expect of him when he came from that situation. Yeah. But does anyone intervene at any point in time to remove him or help him in that particular situation?
Yeah, which echoes the Catholic Bishop's official movie review of the film, which I was surprised it was not morally offensive. It was not an O, but it was the old A4 or the L, the limited adult. Like, you have to be really, like... Yeah. You got to know the liturgy to be able to handle this film, people. Kind of Catholic rating. And the thing that review said, which is, I think, maybe in the way that it might be also a commentary on post-war Irish society, perhaps, is that, yes, every societal entity, whether it's parents, priests, the police, the local, anybody, who would have, could have, should have helped this kid or intervened for this kid,
you know, people knew how to scold. And so then the second, you know, one of the second, third scenes of the film is Mrs. Nugent, his nemesis, doing this, like, sassy, indignant walk down the alley in her bright green dress to go scold Francie Brady. And the one of the few times that the camera ever pulls away from Francie, he's leaving this shop and there's these three women that he would joke around with. And one of them says, oh, you know, he never had a chance.
Right.
You know, and they're aware. That even snaps us as a viewer, and his mom's like, oh, well, he's, you know, beyond good and evil or something at this point. But yes, everything that could have helped this kid or saved this kid or worked for this kid before the big, bad, dramatic Francie Brady is a really bad bastard moment.
And we ended up talking about that scene because the majority of the movie, it is really you are spending your time with Francie. When he leaves that, you know, he's leaving the store when they make that comment. And so we were talking about that. Like, did he break the formula? For me, I actually think it's he probably overheard the comment.
Yeah.
Because I think that's also a theme of the film is that people kind of keep making comments about him, calling him a pig, calling his family a pig, saying these bad things about his dad that he hears, but they're assuming he doesn't hear, though he's there. Which I think actually also kind of builds towards why he does what he does towards the end of the film, is there is also, not only is he in a difficult situation, a traumatic situation, everybody else also looks at him like he is, his family's gross and nasty, and the people that you would cross when you see them walking down the street, you would cross to the other side of the road. And so not only that, not only is he like isolated, there's also social humiliation that's happening in the community with how he's treated.
Yeah, which again is the saying is like this society is very capable of, or this small town, which again is maybe part of the dynamics when we first saw the film. We were in a small town where everybody knew everybody's anything. If there was an awkward hookup on a Saturday night, if you hadn't found out about that by Tuesday, you were out of the loop, man. You were not with it. You didn't know that so-and-so slept with so-and-so. If you didn't find that out by Tuesday, like, what were you even, who even are you? You know? And so it very much spoke to me at that time.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think it's, you know, you also have to think about it. He's a child at the time, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe 10, 11, 12, you know, going through this. And so, like, you have, he has the weight of his parents' dysfunctional relationship. He has the weight of social isolation. He has the weight of public humiliation. He has the weight of losing his friend. He has the weight of actually starting to lose his mind. He has the weight of people not caring for him. And he eventually breaks. And it's easy to see why he ends up breaking.
Yeah, which I think, is something I needed to be a more of an adult to see and needed this distance from this film. Because it also, I think the other thing we have to admit, it is a very rich cinematic world.
It is.
I've never been to Ireland in 1961. We'll probably never go to Ireland in 1961.
Would love until to that go to time Ireland. Machine is invented.
Yeah, until that time machine is invented and we start to do that kind of tourism. As an American seeing this film, which I think is also another part of why the film appealed to us then, it is time and space travel. I mean, it is absolutely a form of tourism that you get this completely, this culture that is recognizable enough. They still speak in English, but it's, you know, that English, Irish English.
And at times, hard to understand.
And at times, there are times when it's hard to understand, which is maybe why this film wasn't a bigger, you know, more people didn't see it than they should have. But it's a very rich world. I mean, every interior shot, it's a beautifully shot film. Mm-hmm. I mean, the interior shots of these homes, of this idyllic little town that's got all these evil, terrible things happening, the countryside, the scenes where Francie is imagining or dreaming the atomic bomb, where he's in and out of different institutions. All of those things are just visually stunning.
Yeah.
And the spectacle and the subtlety of the film as Francis escalates in his behavior, and we find out why he's in that bed in the first scene. It can be very, you know, this is a film maybe that does deserve to be watched more than once.
Mm-hmm. And it has great acting. I mean, Stephen Ray's in it. And so if you're an independent film fan, you say Neil Jordan probably, when he gets a film, is like, oh, let me call Stephen Ray and see if he's available. Yeah. He's done, I think, the majority of Neil Jordan's films. But it's a very, very well-acted film as well. Even with the character, the actor for Francis Brady, he did an amazing job because it's a very complex character that he's trying to convey, and he was just a random schoolboy that was picked to be that character. The other thing I think is fascinating about this movie is the relationship with Joe, who is his best friend. Mm. And so after we get out of the hospital, we see his connection and relationship with Joe. And Joe seems to be this really figure that grounds him in reality. And it seems like as their friendship unravels is when you see Francie unravel even more. But that relationship and watching it the second time, now that actually we're older and we've had friends who've gone through substance abuse issues and mental health issues, when you see a friend unravel, how difficult that is to understand and manage that space. And yeah, to be a little boy, to be Joe, and seeing your friend unravel and trying to understand what's happening. You know, this kid that you would play with all the time, you have a secret fort with, you would scream at fish to fuck off together.
Yeah. In that way that only the Irish can say fuck. I think fuck is my favorite word. Maybe fuck in an Irish accent is perhaps the best fuck there is.
Yeah. So, you know, them screaming fuck off fish together. And then to see Francie take this turn. And Joe tries to help him. Joe tries to get him back on the path. He does try through the blood brother scene to, you know, in a way get Francie to promise to calm himself down and not to do certain things again. And that's not even enough to help Francie get back on track. And then that relationship unraveling becomes the driving force for more severe things that happen during the film.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. What do I talk? The spoilers. I guess the other thing is that for me is interesting is, you know, the way the movie does class. Mm-hmm. You know, his nemesis, the Nugents, are better off.
Yeah.
There is even, you know, that way for Ireland, you know, before, you know, this is decades before the Celtic Tiger. You think they made this movie during the, quote, Celtic Tiger era, the beginning of the Celtic Tiger. That the one cousin got a job in London, you know, and is a supervisor and has people beneath him was such a big deal.
Yeah.
That, you know, England is still seen as this place where culture and wealth happens and where the work is, and
yeah, know. That's so true, because at one point he does run away to Dublin, and it's not like this exciting scene of Dublin to be honest with you. It's like dirty and noisy and the river's like bleak. And so there isn't any like cosmopolitanism about Dublin in any way, shape or form when he visits Dublin, when he decides to run away from home for a period of time.
Yeah. Anything else? I think, without giving it away, I think the other thing, actually, there is one other thing, and that is for me, but I couldn't think of it, but we'll have to maybe think about it on a hot mic. Films where we are with a protagonist, we are in that protagonist's very rich personal world, and the way and the moments in which that protagonist then eventually does something profoundly evil and wrong and crosses a line. I mean, a period, I think, of the time, like Falling Down is a film. You can draw a straight line between Clockwork Orange, Butcher Boy, and a favorite film of ours that nobody on this podcast has seen, the French-Canadian film It's Not Me, I Swear. Find that one. It's a beautiful film. Which I think in a weird way also influenced Moonrise Kingdom, so you can actually... That's...
I actually was thinking the same thing. Like, it's this interesting line to Moonrise Kingdom.
Yes.
With all of those films in between. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, the Clockwork Orange, if you viewed him as a scampish figure, and then as his behavior escalated, you know, I could see being shocked by Alex and Clockwork Orange and, like, the choices that he makes. But I think, yeah, I mean, I cannot off the top of my head...
It's Woody Allen's Match Point, where...
That's true.
...the protagonist is profoundly evil.
Yeah.
And you're with him, and are you almost rooting for him?
Yeah.
To get away with it.
Yeah. No, you know. That is true. That's a good example of it.
And I guess that is, you know, again, why maybe this film was not as popular as it should be. I think it is a hard pill to swallow once. Or it does it well, but ultimately you can walk out of that film, and certainly the Roger Ebert review reflects this, you can walk out of this film and you're like, that's a cute Irish kid, but wow.
Yeah, and I think, well, you know, I think the unsettling part about it is because, as you mentioned, the narrator is very sweet, right? He's just has this amazing voice and is just kind of talking about, you know, the initial narration is just really about this.
It's pastoral.
It's pastoral. This boy living his life in rural Ireland and getting into scrapes. And that's really, like, what it is. And then suddenly it makes a turn.
Yeah.
And it takes a really dark turn. So I think it would have been acceptable if this was a horror movie. Had been a horror movie, that trope of the innocent boy gone bad is you see that in many horror films. And so I think if it had been a horror film rather than this family drama or this drama, that people would have accepted it more. And that's why I think it makes it more shocking is that as he progresses, because he's this sweet looking boy, right, who's this misguided boy, you don't expect things to go the way they do, and I think that's why it's jarring for people.
And I think also I should think that I laughed out loud at the scene that was after the most horrific scene in the film is also maybe borderline one of the funniest scenes I've ever seen in a film. You know, as all of these people who are waiting for the revelation of the Virgin Mother.
Yeah.
You know, come upon this scene of gore.
Yes.
In a really delightful sort of way, which again, I felt naughty and good, you know, and right and stuff.
So I do think that's a good point. I think it's also important to talk about the Catholicism and how it's portrayed in this film, because... as we know, I mean, even up until recently, Catholicism really ruled Ireland, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, abortion laws just happened not too long ago.
Divorce laws happened during our lifetime. Yeah. In fact, what, you know, this film came out, was it 2 years, 3 years? 98, homosexuality was still a criminal behavior.
Yeah.
Into the 90s. And that was 93, I think, in Ireland. So
Catholicism does, of course, because it's Ireland, it does play a huge role in this particular film.
The priests are the pillars of the community. And...
But it's, like, interesting in the sense that they actually are not helpful in any way, shape, or form in this movie. In a particular situation, harmful.
Yeah.
In a situation. Mary, the Virgin Mary, plays a really big role in this film.
And says fuck.
And says fuck.
In that wonderful Irish way.
She's also the harbinger of doom in many ways for him. Because when you think about when he starts having his visions and conversations with her, it kind of escalates his behavior.
Yeah, which is an interesting, you know, that divine revelation and madness are the same moment.
Yeah.
Are the same thing, and you can't differentiate between divine revelation and madness,
and I think,
which I think is a fascinating little nugget in there.
And I agree with you. And to Roger Ebert's connection with The Clockwork Orange, you know, Alex embraces religion to show that he's not a bad bastard anymore and to get out of jail. where this becomes Francie's plan, and Francie does try to, he becomes an altar boy.
Yes.
He hears the priest talking about, you know, children having visions of Mary, so he starts having visions of Mary. And instead of believing that, you know, they all believed that they were visions that he was having instead of actually auditory hallucinations that he was having. And so it was allowed and actually encouraged, which has to make you wonder if that helped him along his path and the choices that he made.
Well, I guess for me, that's the thing about whether it's madness or evil, the role of evil in this film. The people who are just beyond are beyond and are totally uninhibited. What are they capable of? Because everybody else assumes the best. Or assumes that someone's harmless. Not to go for the, like, you gotta be paranoid about everybody thing, but there is an element to all of these people. Oh, there's good in Francie. He's fine. He's so disarming.
Well, I think it is a really great discussion about how mental illness is viewed.
Yeah.
And that's part of the big issue in this film, is how mental illness is viewed for Francie. We just watched that documentary, Bedlam, Independent Lens, and, you know, it's still, mental health issues are still ignored and not paid attention to and aren't given this, you know, people who are experienced that are not given the support that they need. And so for Francie, he becomes a victim of his mental health and people ignoring mental health and assuming that you could beat it out of him, beat these behaviors out of him, or you could guilt the behaviors out of him. And it's just not the case. He has a mental illness. Yeah. He is struggling. And the choices that he make, now that we're older, right? Because when we first saw this film, we would have been in our 20s. Now that we're in our 40s and we both work with students, and you see some of the choices that he makes and you say, that's not a typical response of an 11, 12-year-old. 11, 12-year-old doesn't do this in response to stress, you know? And so he is exhibiting these atypical behaviors that should be signaling to everybody that there's something else going on. They also mentioned early on in the film, his mom says he was like 5 pounds when he was born.
5 pounds what? Yeah.
So you have to also wonder, was mom drinking at the time as well? Because the dad is an alcoholic. Or did dad beat her and he was born early? But 5 pounds is not typical for a baby, right? Yeah. And so to be born, so was he born premature, either through alcoholism or through beating? And so automatically being premature and being that small, the brain development doesn't occur the way it should. And that can impact a lot of things. And that can also impact mental health. If she was an alcoholic, that would have impacted him as well. And mom seems to have her own mental health issues. And you have to wonder if dad had his own mental health issues and was he self-medicating through alcohol. And so you have this boy who is crying for help in many ways. And then let alone trauma, right? I mean, trauma actually does impact how you interact with the world. It impacts your ability to make sound decisions. So he has all of this around him, surrounding him, that everyone knows, right? Like everybody in the town, the funny part about it is everyone in the town knows, right? Like they all know what's happening in his life and no one's like, oh, you know what? That might mess up a boy. Maybe we should help him out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, part of the Catholicism is, can you pray away things, right? So can you pray away having mental health issues? Can you pray away the bad? And that's how he's dealt with. Or smacked, you know, the one priest just kind of smacks him a few times instead of actually saying, what is the root of his problem and how do we help this boy?
Yeah. So, I guess it's time for the big five questions.
Sure.
First question, of course, being, is it camp, retro, classic, or just an old movie?
For me, it's a classic.
Yeah.
I think it's just, it's beautifully shot. It's well acted. The story is amazing. I mean, it's hard to talk about the film because you don't want to give away what happens in the movie. Yeah. So, as Matt said, just find this movie and watch it.
And one time, because we owned it on VHS and it was like, you got to come over to my house and watch this movie. There was actually a friend of ours who fell asleep, who then, he borrowed this tape. And then I knew exactly when he watched it. Because the big moment, he actually called. My phone rings and I pick it up. And he's like, why didn't you wake me up when that was going to happen? So
it is a slow burn, but if you stick with it, it is well worth sticking
with.
It's
a visually rich
yeah.
slow burn, though. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it is amusing. I mean, there are very funny moments to this film. I envy anyone who hasn't seen it yet who's going to see it.
Yeah.
Because watching this film for the first time is special and unique. So it's a classic. It's another lost classic.
Yeah.
You know, to keep ourselves honest, we're going to have to do a movie we hate at some point. True. Before number 10, we got to do one we hate, at least. But I was so happy when you pulled this out of the basement last night. Like, yes, let's do that movie. Okay, two, what about the social political distance of the film? Sort of the Bechdel test, things about race, things about gender.
So, I mean, in terms of race, it is very white.
It's Ireland.
It's yeah. Ireland. Gender, like, so you think about the women. So, mom is unstable and suicidal. Mrs. Nugent is his nemesis, who calls him a pig to his face, sends her brothers to beat the crap out of him. Then you have Virgin Mary, who is a soothing figure, supposedly, in his life, but she also does egg him on. So my favorite part one of the parts I think is the funniest, one of the funny parts, is at the end of the movie, the Virgin Mary appears to him after decades of not appearing, and he goes, oh shit. Because he knows that if he's seeing her, there's something happening again. And she brings up Joe, which Joe had been this catalyst for all this other behavior. So the three prominent female figures are not great, right? So there isn't any strong female figure in this film who supports him or helps him.
Which is maybe, again, a testament of the time
yeah,
and the place and the way that I think, for me, also there's this way that it maybe does capture the post-war years.
Yeah.
And a different look at the post-war years, you know. Maybe you also pair this movie with, like, The Seagull of Laughter, the great Icelandic
true.
Film that we love, 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 that's post-war
yeah.
Iceland, that we will not be reviewing on this podcast because we own it on DVD, so...
Yeah, you have to be VHS, Laserdisc, or...
CED.
CED.
And I have purchased a Betamax, so we'll have Betamax at some point. That's a big announcement. So in terms of the technical distance, how does the room look? How does the film look today?
I still think it looks really good. I think there's the scene where he's hallucinating that some people are aliens. That kind of looks a little bit cheesy, but I think it's supposed to look cheesy. It kind of mirrors what the look of a film from the 1960s would look like with aliens. So I don't want to say it's because of lack of ability to do something more interesting. I think it was very purposeful.
Mm-hmm.
I do think the scene with the atomic bomb looks really good.
Yeah, it's good. That's really good CGI. That's CGI that has not aged. Yeah. In terms of maybe the room test, I think I talked earlier in terms of the sort of mise-en-scene. I mean,
yeah.
It is... I would gander that entire film is period correct. The furniture, the appliances, the cars, the fashion... All of it is, the look of the film is so visually rich. And you're just sucked in. You're not, I was not at any point like pulled out of the film by the way it looked or the setting or anything. So I think the last question is pretty obvious. Question five, is the Butcher Boy a keeper? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This is one, actually, I am tempted to upgrade. Like, I love this VHS. I'm going to have VHS is forever or whatever. I love having this VHS in my hand right now. But this is one that maybe, you know, we could own this on, like, DVD or Blu-ray or something.
I think that's a good point. So it is the last Geffen film that was made.
Oh, that's really important,
Geffen,
too. Yeah.
Geffen brought us Interview with a Vampire, Beetlejuice. So Geffen brought us some very interesting films. Geffen did become DreamWorks after a period of time.
Yes.
And then, you know, of course, they both have been dissolved. But So it's fascinating that this is the note that they end on, is mm-hmm. The Butcher Boy. It's such a beautiful film, and it's in the hands of Neil Jordan. So it's in the hands of a very capable director who took this story, and he co-wrote the screenplay with the... It's from based on a book. So he co-wrote the screenplay with the author of the book, who also played the drunkard in the town drunkard.
Oh,
that's the author of the book.
Oh, wonderful.
So he, you know, and it's they talked about the difficulty of taking that book, which does really talk about him hearing voices and his descent into madness, and how do you translate that into film. And so the article I was reading, they said the first version was just too out there. Like, they just didn't feel like audiences would be able to follow and make sense of it. But, you know, they did such an amazing job taking this really complex story and weaving it together into just this gorgeous cinematic experience. So it's definitely, for me, a keeper. And I feel like if we didn't like the film, we would have given all the spoilers away
yeah,
of what happened.
Whoever you are, see this film. Make it happen. And you will not be disappointed. You might be shocked. You might be terrified. You might be nauseated. You might be traumatized. See it. It's worth seeing. It's such an amazing film.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way to end it.
Absolutely. We're out.